Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute. Today, I'm joined by journalist and innovator Matthew Bishop. Matthew spent more than 25 years as a journalist at The Economist, including as business editor and New York bureau chief. He also led the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center and is currently a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute and the Sorensen Institute. I've been lucky enough to work with Matthew on projects at the Edelman Trust Institute and get his expert takes on trust for more than two decades. Matthew, it's a pleasure having you here.
Great to be with you, Justin.
I'm really looking forward to our conversation, and particularly so because you recently edited the Edelman Trust Institute's third annual publication, which is a compendium of essays by global experts and leaders reflecting on trust throughout this year and looking ahead to the new year. This year's publication, titled Evolving Trust, Embracing Change, provides insights on how to overcome the trust deficit and help humanity emerge from times of change. Tell us more about the publication.
Yeah, this year we wanted to really focus on the challenge of taking the realization that trust is missing, that we have a big trust deficit, and looking at what can actually be done practically to rebuild trust. The kind of level of trust in the societal institutions, in business, in the philanthropic world and nonprofit world that will help us navigate what I think we all recognize is a sort of unprecedented period of change that has the potential to change massively for the better, but also to go horribly much for the worse. And trust is going to be maybe the determining factor of which way it goes. So we reached out to a group of really expert thinkers on trust to ask them what their practical advice was.
What are some of the contributors that you want to talk to us about today?
Well, I think one is Dubar Afayan, who is the CEO of Flagship Pioneering, which is a pharmaceutical company that creates new pharmaceutical companies. And one of the ones that he was involved in founding was Moderna, which was one of the companies that brought us the new vaccines in the height of the pandemic that helped us get out of it and back to something close to normality very quickly. And I really was interested to see from hear from him, you know, what he'd learned from that experience and, you know, what he hoped would happen to create the possibility that we don't have the kind of chaos next time there's a pandemic, but actually we'll be able to be more confident, more trusting in our leaders next time around.
This was an interview you did with Nubar. Much of the collection is essays. In that interview, Nubar talks about the role of trust in terms of what might be different next time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, his point was that actually you need trust most when you're in a situation where things are changing, where we've never been there before, and you're relying on people to lead who you know necessarily aren't really masters of all the facts that they need. And so why do you trust those people? What has to be in place to make it more than just an act of desperation? And he said, obviously, actually, a lot of the time we do default to trust in our leaders out of desperation. And that happened at the start of the pandemic. And very quickly, people lost trust because the leaders didn't rise to the occasion. And I think he makes the point that I thought was very powerful, that a lot of the experts during the pandemic talked with confidence about stuff they didn't know because they hadn't been there either. And that actually undermined trust because they pretended to have knowledge that they didn't have. And then they lost trust completely. And that made the problem of then, you know, getting people to take their vaccines and so forth much harder than it would have been.
What advice would you give to experts now if they were trying to build trust?
Well, his advice, and I think he's right, is if you don't know the answer, tell people you don't know the answer, but then also tell them what you're doing to find out the answer and how you're going to keep them informed of what you learn and get back to them quickly. And that way they'll see that you are expert enough not to feel you have to pretend to have knowledge you don't have. And actually, I think that's a rule that could apply almost across all leadership roles, politicians even more so than maybe some of the academic experts. You know, often politicians feel they just can't ever admit that they don't know something. And that's probably why we have so little faith in them.
Seems like good advice for any kind of leader.
Absolutely.
Turning to one of the other contributors, Zainab Salbi and Casey Rogers of Daughters for Earth wrote about building trust in philanthropies. And part of their point was giving power to people on the front lines on the issues that they're aiming to address. You've worked in philanthropic organizations. You wrote a book about philanthropy. What do you make of this approach to trust building?
Yeah, I think this theme of trust-based philanthropy is a growing trend because so much philanthropy and so much aid, actually, international aid is also having the same debate, has failed to really change things. And I think there's a growing realization that the reason, one of the reasons it's failed to change things is that the people who are on the ground, who are supposedly being helped, are actually the people who know best what's needed. And yet, so often, the people with the money who are coming supposedly to help come with their own agendas, their own lack of trust in the people they're trying to help. And so we have this essay by Zainab and Casey that really describes how their new philanthropy organization that they lead, Daughters for Earth, actually set out to create a new structure that built trust in the people that are being helped to help themselves into its DNA, and how difficult that was and how much resistance there was internally. And so it's an honest take on how their own organization struggled, even though it had embraced this message that you've got to trust the people on the ground, that they found it very hard to get out of the habits of a top-down approach and a lack of trust.
Do you feel like what they write about offers lessons for NGO trust building in general?
There are a lot of lessons, I think, in what they found, and it'll be interesting to watch how it goes, because it's still a quite young organization, how they can keep this going in practice. But I think generally they found that when you do trust people on the ground, and their concerns were things like, will these people really turn up to meetings and know how to operate in a meeting? Will they make wise decisions? But actually, yeah, there's a lot of knowledge that people have as to how they could do things differently and better, that if you just simply let them, empower them by giving them the resources they need to do it, that actually they can get it done much better than you as an outsider can ever do.
I feel like all sorts of organizations talk about centrally managed but locally informed. How do you actually disperse power locally, though?
Well, I think in their case, they said, you know, although the meetings where decisions are taken, you know, the leaders of the organization can come along, they weren't allowed to make any interventions, and that actually the decisions that were taken as to how the money should be used, those decisions would be honored by the hierarchy of the organization. So it was a real institutionalized letting go of just some significant decision-taking rights.
Another theme throughout multiple essays in the collection is the need to put people at the center of strategy, certainly what we were just talking about. And that can apply to rolling out AI, addressing climate change. What are the ways that business leaders can be thinking about better prioritizing people?
Yeah, I mean, the question ultimately is why is there so little trust in certain key institutions? And I think one of the factors has been this centralization trend of the last few decades, which has taken away a lot of the human engagement that brings with it a natural tendency to trust. You tend to trust someone that you've spent time with, you've been in the same room as, that you feel there's some, you know, you look them in the eye and so forth. And that actually we need to find ways as organizations to reintroduce real human interaction. There have been some efforts to take away cash registers and tills, and just, you know, the people that used to work at those registers were all let go, and it was going to be all automated. And now there's a backlash against that because people actually find it more hassle dealing with this impersonal machine than they did having the engagement with real humans. And I think that part of the trust building, you know, formula is one that a lot of organizations need to wake up to.
Well, I even love retailers where people come out from the till and the person you've been speaking to that helped you find the right size and the thing that you feel confident in how it looks can actually just ring you up right there with something mobile.
And I think the point that's made in the article on AI by Mei-Ling Fung is that actually AI, if it's going to achieve its potential, has to be embedded in actually solving human problems. And a lot of that means involving humans in the solutions by giving them the ability to use the AI to improve their ability to do the job, but actually not to replace them. And I think maybe a lot of people in business certainly view AI as a way to cut costs rather than empower their people to do a better job. And so that's going to be one of the big tests of whether AI is really beneficial to humanity, is if it really improves everyone's lives rather than just improves the balance sheet and the profits.
And how do you think leaders and business leaders can actually take that thoughtful approach to AI?
Ben Malin makes two points that I think are very powerful. One is, first of all, it's been the history throughout, certainly the last 50 years of the internet, of when new digital technologies have been rolled out, they become the hot thing. Everyone rolls them out, and often people don't really understand why they're doing it, what they're doing, what the consequences are going to be of this new technology, and as a result, lots of bad things happen that you then have to put right afterwards. And so she's saying, you know, firstly, if you're going to use this new technology, make sure you understand how it works, what it does, and why you're using it, and make sure that's going to actually improve things for your customers and your stakeholders, and as well as improving your profits. The second thing she says is that actually there are in other parts of the economy, like in healthcare, for example, new structures that have been evolved where you try new innovative approaches within the context of a deliberately set up group of people who are going to report back. You're going to get real-time data on the impact of this stuff, and there's going to be a collaborative approach to making sure that the new technology, the new innovation actually does improve things for people. And there's no reason why we can't do that with AI rather than have it all just delivered top-down and, you know, any data that's being generated being kept secret.
Can you imagine a scenario where a company finds data that goes against what you might have been hoping and you're transparent in sharing that data? What are some of the kind of transparency around either the pitfalls or what is going wrong along the process?
Yeah, I think you can involve the public much more, the customer, the workforce much more in designing the experiments that you roll out, as well as create trusted arrangements whereby the data is being shared outside of the walls of the organization that owns the data. Now, you can find ways of anonymizing or whatever and protecting some of the intellectual property if you need to, whilst also making available enough of the data in a form that can be analyzed so that there's public good knowledge being created as well.
There's a way I'm connecting this back in my head to where we started this conversation around COVID and experts. Is there a fear around sharing data like that, experts sharing what they understand the truth to be and frightening the public or frightening constituents? And I feel like that's often a reason that's being used for keeping information closer.
Maybe, but I think people are already quite concerned about what some of this new technology, particularly AI, might do. And actually, there's a pretty good chance that getting real data will allow the public to have a real conversation based on facts, and maybe we'll learn what good things are happening as well as what bad things might be happening. I think there's a broader point, which actually Eric Beinhocker makes in his essay, which is that one of the reasons trust is so low is that many, many people feel that they are being screwed by the system, that there's massive inequality, both of income and wealth, but also of involvement in decision-making and of power, and that the social contract that societies need in order to be able to navigate change is broken, very badly broken. And, you know, there's a general perception that our leaders have lied to us or not been candid with us, and therefore people feel someone who I think is honest, even if I don't like what they stand for. And they come along and they tap into that anger at the establishment leadership and get elected or get big surges in their popularity. And I think that is one of the big challenges we face at the moment. And I think it comes back to people who are in leadership making claims that didn't actually stand up to the what actually then happened, and then kind of lying about it or not admitting the mistakes, not admitting the failures, and then that pretty quickly the public feels actually I don't trust these people and I don't trust these institutions, and then we get the mess that we have now, and heading into a year 2024 when you know there's major elections in a number of the world's most important democracies where there are very serious risks of people getting elected as the world's leaders who have really run against the establishment rather than with an agenda that actually is going to actually make people better off.
So you've painted a pretty dire and scary picture of the current trust crisis. You've edited this publication for a number of years. You've been a student of trust for decades. Paint the more positive picture. What are the steps that leaders and institutions can take to be building trust?
Yeah, well, if we start with that very big picture of why the world leaders are held in so little regard and so distrusted, I think just being candid about, yeah, we failed, we made mistakes. These are the kind of mistakes we think we made. This is why we made them, and this is what we've learned from it, and this is why we're going to try this differently. Having that honest conversation, you know, which goes against all the rules of politics, which, you know, you should always claim you're doing well, but it actually would make people feel, okay, at least we're dealing with people who are willing to admit their mistakes. That would be a good start. And then to start to talk about how you reform the institutions, the organizations that are mistrusted at the moment in ways that will, I think, really engage the general public much more in decision making and in when you're having an experiment that's being run that you're involved in. I mean, that the slogan goes, you know, nothing about us without us. You know, that philosophy, I think, will make people very quickly at least stop being virulently mistrustful of their leaders and will be the start of a building of trust.
Are you seeing businesses that have successfully built trust, and what are some of those qualities?
The Edelman Trust Barometer, for example, finds is that a lot of businesses are trusted to nowadays to deliver products that do what they say they're going to do, which wasn't always the case. You know, so there's been a big, in terms of just execution of the basic business promise, a lot of industries now, there's quite high levels of trust. It's where there are decisions that take, as Nubar Afian says again in his piece, where you move into areas of unknown, that's where maybe you need to be more honest about what the risks are and how you're going to put in place checks and balances and safety nets and things that allow us to navigate these very unpredictable changes that are coming up in ways that are going to, in the end, be good for society.
You come from the media. You spent decades as a journalist and an editor, and you're certainly continue as a student of the media. What do you see as the role of media, and particularly at this moment when there are so many unknowns and new technologies being rolled out? What should the role of media be, or how do you see the role of media shifting?
Well, I think media, certainly the news media, has a incredibly important role to play because, you know, it exists to make sure that we're operating in an environment where we have the facts about what's really going on. I think that the news organizations I've seen close up put a huge value on fact and accuracy, and they have fact checkers. If you do lie or make a story up or exaggerate it or whatever, you're going to be fired typically, or certainly you're going to, it's going to be a setback for your career as a journalist. And so I think it firstly getting that message out that we really do have processes in place that, you know, in the media mean that you can trust the mainstream media in certain ways about its factual accuracy in a way that you can't maybe trust other news sources, is important to tell that story. But also two other things. One is you've got to make sure that you live up to that. And I think some of the news media sometimes get that everyone has their unconscious agendas at some level that can sometimes twist their interpretations. So being aware of your unconscious biases. But I mean, that's what you've got to do, and to be constantly watching out for that. but also to educate readers in how to consume news as well, and to understand that you should rely on multiple news sources, that some news organizations come from a particular perspective, and therefore you want to not discount that perspective entirely and what they're saying entirely, but you want to make sure that you're checking from multiple organizations to get a more complete picture. And I think one of the essays that we have is quite helpful in just giving advice on how to be a good news consumer, and actually also calls on other leaders to stand up for news media, but also to explain how they get their facts as well, and to make sure that they see themselves as having a role to play in educating the general public in how to consume news.
I wonder, though, also with the media, have you seen a shift in the dynamic between media and the other institutions? So I'm almost talking about, like, literally how media interacts with people from the business world and the NGO world. Has something shifted over the years?
Well, I mean, two obvious points to make, and there are a lot of points on this one. But one is that the media business itself has gone through a business model transformation, because a lot of the traditional advertising and the local monopolies have been sort of undermined by the internet and social media. And so a lot of news organizations have gone through sort of near-death or actual death experiences, and those that have survived have, I think, are still very chastened about needing to make sure that they're making money. And that, I think, is much more, that's had an effect on what their choices are of what they cover and maybe how they cover things. And there's much more of a coziness that isn't always good, I think, there between the media and some of the people paying for the content. The other part is, obviously, we are in a world where the way the social media models have evolved has encouraged people towards sources that reinforce their own opinions and prejudices and take them away from other sources that maybe challenge them, because everyone likes to have their own prejudices reinforced. And that is a huge problem, because it's created these what they call filter bubbles that I think really are part of the increasing polarization in society, and the fact that this next year's set of elections, where AI is going to be increasing the ability of those that want to spread misinformation to target misinformation at people that are vulnerable to it. It makes me very worried about how those elections are going to be really not based around a real discussion of the facts, but based more on, building up polarized positions.
Based on your answer, I'm concerned that perhaps media isn't enforcing its watchdog function. Is that fair to say?
No, I think media is doing its darndest to enforce its watchdog function. I think it's up against, and in fact, again, Nubar makes this point that, that distrust has been weaponized in a way that wouldn't have been possible before social media. The fact that we're on our phones all day and we're looking at information that is coming from who knows where and is now at a level of sophistication that we've never seen before. There's fake news out there in all sorts of ways, and that's going to get much more high tech. It's just a much harder job to play that watchdog function. But one of the things that that has been encouraged is for people not to trust the mainstream media when it does play that watchdog function. And so, we're in a world where actually a lot more information about bad things has come to light, but actually it's not trusted, even though it may be true.
So looking ahead to 2024, you mentioned the elections in multiple countries in 2024. How concerned are you, and it certainly seems from your answers that you're highly concerned about the role of misinformation, polarization, the types of leaders that might be coming to the fore. What's your, maybe not literal prognostication about these elections, but what are some of the trends that you're watching?
Well, I think we just need to be very wary of this misinformation problem. We need to do whatever we can to, I think, create in-person forums where people can get together with people who disagree with them and at least feel like they're not part of another tribe. So the more we can break down these barriers between people that have reinforced the polarization, the better. I think these elections probably going to be much more determined by whether there's a real local discussion around local issues that maybe reflect the broader national issues, and whether those are based on othering and polarization, or whether they're based on really coming together as communities around issues and trying to figure them out, will have a big effect on the kind of people that those communities vote for ultimately. And so I think there's a real danger that the world ends up at the end of 2024 with leaders who maybe are more trusted by part of the population, but whose long-term legacy will be to further fuel distrust. And my hope is that those who are fighting for a more unified, unifying kind of agenda will take very seriously the practical ideas that are in this volume of essays about what you can do to cut through the volume of misinformation to actually build trust. And as I say, being more humble, being more honest about your failures, being more willing to admit that there are problems and that you don't know have all the answers. You know, it sounds like a very risky strategy for anyone running for election, but I wonder whether the public's appetite for authenticity, you know, will respond better to that than it will to people who just say that they have all the answers and we're going to fix everything for you.
What a hopeful and practical way to end this conversation and to look ahead to 2024. Matthew, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to The Trustmakers. If you enjoy the show, be sure to subscribe and consider taking some time to write a review. And if you're looking for more trust context and applications, subscribe to the Edelman Trust Institute's newsletter via the link in the show notes, where you will also find the link to the publication that Matthew edited. We'll be back next time with more insights on how to build trust in today's society.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.